Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. From Austrian soil to Vatican soil. Legends surrounding the Christmas tree and flowers that bloom around Christmas. First, I'd like to bring you the latest news from the Vatican, where at a press conference on Friday, 12th of December, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith issued a document focusing on bioethics, which bears the title of Instruction Dignitas Personae on Certain Bioethical Questions. Chris Altieri spoke to the Undersecretary of this congregation, Dominican Father Joseph Augustin Di Noia, about it. Let's listen to this exclusive interview.
The document is really a companion document to one that appeared in 1987 called Donum Vitae. And I would say that the principles articulated by Donum Vitae about the sacredness of the beginning of life, those principles remain applicable in this new document, which is called the Dignity of the Person, or Dignitas Personae. So that in that sense, there's a vision of the human person which is consistent, and which the Magisterium of the Church has always proposed, that we see human beings not just as physical beings, but as physical spiritual beings with a destiny beyond that God is calling us to, and that in viewing all the moral issues, including those in bioethics, we have to take that larger sort of picture of what it means to be human into account.
Father Di Noia, what's new in this document then? You say that in principle everything is the same. Now, to a certain extent, people who are familiar with Catholic thinking are not going to be surprised by this. But the question is there, isn't it? Why this new document
at
all?
Yes. This the very point of this document was to take account of new developments in the area of medical technology and scientific studies on these issues that have emerged in the 20 or so years since Donum Vitae. Because there are new developments in these areas, there is an attempt to apply the principles of moral theology as they affect bioethics to these new developments.
We'll hear often that the Church is against stem cell research. The Church says no to stem cell research, for example. Some people say that the Church says no to just about everything. What would you have to say to people who take that general position, and would you have anything to clarify regarding the Church's position on stem cells? Is there anything perhaps that this document specifically clarifies?
Yes. Perhaps I'll begin with that first and then go to the larger issue. With regard to stem cell research, the Church is very clear that stem cells derived from other sources than the embryo is perfectly legitimate. The issue with stem cell research that is morally problematic is to treat the embryo, which is, from the Church's perspective, a living human being, as the basis for, this is going to sound a little bit crude, spare parts. That is to say, to treat the embryo, not to recognize the full human dignity of the embryo, and to use it in order to experiment in a way that would be, well, I mean, I suppose the Nazis did it, but unthinkable if you were talking about grown, fully formed human beings. But this use of the embryo for the sake of experimentation and even for therapeutic purposes, that is what is excluded. But the church totally supports all of the kind of stem cell research, which is, by the way, although not directly applicable morally, much more fruitful, apparently, for therapeutic purposes. Many people think, especially in the area of healthcare, which is really where we are, essentially, medicine and healthcare, they think of Catholic teaching in terms of prohibited services. That is, they think of all of the things that you cannot do if you're a Catholic hospital, a Catholic physician, a Catholic nurse, whatever. These no's, as the Holy Father has said many times, Pope Benedict has said this, these no's are derived from very large yes, and many, many, if you would, if I may put it that way, smaller yeses. I mean, the large yes is the yes to the dignity of human life. I mean, Dignitas Personae states at the very outset that it wishes to emphasize the great yes to human life. That's a quote. And this is a positive, sort of resounding, fundamental yes to the human life and the integrity, in this case, the integrity of marriage and of the unity of the husband and wife in producing the child in the section on the second part on assisted fertilization. Then there is also a yes to science, the recognition of the scientific developments that have taken place. There's a yes to all the fertility treatments that, in fact, to quote the document, overcome or correct pathologies and succeed in reestablishing the normal functioning of human procreation. There's a yes to the therapeutic use of stem cells, as I mentioned already. There's a yes to the intrinsic worth, value, and equality of every human being from conception to natural death. So in the end, you know, I mean, I could go on, but this litany of yeses, the yes, some of these affirmations and positive assertions have a negative side, but their principal, I would say, their principal direction is a positive account, a vision of what it means to be human and why human life is sacred, as we say over and over again, and we will, from conception to natural death.
It strikes me that some folks who either cover science or are involved in the scientific enterprise do have the sense that the Catholic Church wants something from them. And perhaps that's not entirely unfair to say, is it? I mean, doesn't the Church expect scientists to behave in a certain way?
Yes, yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Because from the Catholic perspective, and this goes back to the Middle Ages and be contrary to what people commonly think, in the Catholic perspective, sciences have their own, to use the technical term, integrity and finality. So a particular science has its scope, its object, what it studies, and there are criteria for measuring the correctness or the general direction, even when the issues are hypothetical, of a particular scientific proposal. Now, so absolutely the Church respects that. Sometimes the conflicts arise when scientists go outside of the methodological limits, you might say, into what we would call metaphysical or theological matters. So that does create conflict, but let me just go back to the way you framed it. Does the Church need and expect scientists to provide the information that allows the Church then to make moral judgments? And the answer is absolutely yes. Just in the development of this document, I can say that it has been under development for at least 5 years, and that it is based on an enormous amount of consultation, not just of moral theologians, but of physicians and of scientists in these areas. So no moral judgment would be taken or articulated in this document that did not respect, let us say, the point where the science had arrived, so that the church does not make a judgment. For example, let's say, hypothetically, that there were a drug that could conceivably have an abortifacient impact. So that is to say, abort, rather than so just contraception. And now, when there are cases where certain drugs, the science, the jury is out on the science. It's not settled yet. So the document refrains from, you might say, going further with respect to the specific drug now, not with respect to the difference between contraception and abortion. But that's a very good example of where the science is not yet clear, and so the document does not go beyond, but it does attempt to indicate what would be the case morally were the science to have arrived at a certain point.
How important is the way that we talk about this, and what can the church do to inform the public debate?
Indeed, it's the obligation of any morally serious person, church or no church, to let the language allow for the moral judgment to be made one way or the other, so that you're not fooling yourself, if you will, by calling the reproductive choice, using the language reproductive choice to cover the fact that you're really promoting abortion, for example.
A lot of people will object, as they have in the past, to say, well, that's what you Catholics think. We don't share your beliefs, and so we're not even going to listen to you. What would you say to them?
Well, I think that the document, in a sense, is addressed, although it's primarily addressed to people in the church, it certainly intends to have a hearing beyond. And let's put it this way, it is not a matter of divine revelation to know that the life of the innocent should be protected. This is something that all human beings should know, even, I would say, atheists. It's a matter, yes, that revelation illumines, as Pope Benedict has said several times, a revelation illumines the natural powers of human reasoning to understand, to know what is right and wrong, no question. So the church affirms and assists, you might say, reason. But the content of the principles are not divinely revealed. They have to do with things that all men of goodwill, if I may use that expression, who reason, who are capable of moral reasoning and understanding arguments, ought to be able to see. People who are thinking seriously about the consequences of these rapidly developing biotechnologies on the future of the human race. And the church, in that sense, is issuing in this document a kind of wake-up call. The church, as mother, yes, of Christians, but mother of all mankind, too, is duty bound to remind everybody who's paying attention to these issues where these technologies can lead if there is no moral, not limit, but moral perspective guiding their implementation. It's one thing to come up with them, it's another thing to do them. Not everything that can be done ought to be done in these areas.
And our thanks there go to the Undersecretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Dominican Father Joseph Augustine de Noia, who was speaking there to Chris Altieri about the document this congregation issued on Friday by the title of Dignitas Personae on Certain Bioethical Questions. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, on a totally different note, I'd like to focus on plants in the Vatican, a vine and a Christmas tree, both gifts dug out of Austrian soil. The vine to be planted in the Vatican gardens on Saturday morning, and the Christmas tree already in place in St. Peter's Square to be lit up on Saturday afternoon. But while the vine is young, the 108-foot red fir tree is a mere 120 years of age, a tree then that began its life during the pontificate of Pius VI, 14 popes down the line. And it seems this tree will live on, as it will be recycled, given to several companies that make semi-finished products for children, including benches and gazebos for schoolyards or parks, as well as toy boxes and frames. As I crossed St. Peter's Square the other day and looked at the Christmas tree there, I thought to myself, how exactly do Christmas trees tie in with our Christmas traditions? Well, there are plenty of legends about the Christmas tree. And if you listen on with the help of Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett, I'll be recounting some of these. That's not without letting you know first about some of the flowers that bloom at this special time of year, beginning with the poinsettia, or Christmas star. Do stay tuned. Have you ever wondered what flowers, if any, bloomed on the first Christmas night? Well, the answer is we don't really know. But what I can tell you is that the most popular Christmas plant is the poinsettia, with its flaming red leaves that resemble the Star of Bethlehem. Here in Italy, it's simply called the Christmas Star. It seems the plant was introduced into the United States by Dr. Joel Roberts, Poinsett, who brought the plant back to South Carolina with him. And there's a Mexican legend which explains the origin of this flower of the holy night. I've asked my colleague, Jill Bevilacqua, to tell us about it.
One Christmas Eve, a poor young Mexican boy had no gift for the holy child and was very sad, as he had no idea what to do. He made his way slowly to the church for midnight mass, and when he got there, he knelt down on the ground outside the church and prayed to God. "I am very poor, but I love you. I wish I had a gift to give to your son on his birthday." The boy finished his prayer and stood up, and there at his feet he was surprised to see a green plant with dazzling red leaves. He gently broke off the flower from the plant, carried it inside, and laid it before the Christ child.
And so every year at Christmas, the poinsettia blooms, and it's become one of our traditional Christmas symbols. But what about the rose that blooms at Christmas? In the language of flowers, different roses signify different things. The burgundy rose means simplicity and beauty. A faded rose, beauty is fleeting. The yellow rose, infidelity. Medieval legend asserts that the first roses appeared miraculously in Bethlehem as the result of a fair maiden who had been falsely accused and sentenced to death by burning. But Jill has yet another Christmas legend for us about the rose. It comes from France, and it's about a little shepherdess who follows the shepherds into the stable, and while each one of them has a gift for the child, she has none.
The angel Gabriel saw her in tears and asked what was the matter. And when she told him, he said, "What would you like to give?" The little girl thought for a moment and then said, "He has no flowers. If only I could give him roses, but it's winter and the ground's frozen." The angel led the little girl outside and touched the ground with his staff, and immediately it was covered with exquisite tiny wild roses. And to this day the Christmas rose blooms at this season.
But what about the daisy, the flower most children love? Did you know the word means the day's eye? Because the daisy closes its pinky lashes and goes to sleep when the sun sets. but in the morning expands its petals to the light. The Christmas legend about it is also from France. This time it's about a little shepherd boy. He too had no gifts.
There were white daisies in the field, and so he plucked one and offered it to the baby, and the baby kissed the daisy, and where his lips had touched its petals turned rosy pink. And that's why the daisies which grow in the grass have delicate pink-tipped petals.
Let's go from flowers to trees. What about the Christmas tree? It's become so much part of Christmas, so much so that each year now there's even one that stands by the Christmas crib in St. Peter's Square. The decorated Christmas tree was in use at the time of the Romans and came to us from Germany. It was made popular in Britain by Prince Albert soon after his marriage with Queen Victoria in 1840. As a matter of fact, Santa Claus and his reindeer came to England at this very same time. But this is a story of the very first Christmas tree.
One bleak, cold Christmas Eve, Hans the woodcutter sat by his fire with his wife, Gertrude, and their two children, Fritz and Gretchen. Presently they heard a noise outside, as though someone were trying to come into their cottage. They opened the door, and there was a tiny child, very white and cold. They took him in and warmed him and fed him, and that night he slept in the children's bed, while they slept on the hearth. In the night, Gretchen woke and heard singing outside. She called her brother and together they peeped out. There on the doorstep was a little group of angel children. As Fritz and Gretchen stood wondering, they saw that the room behind them had filled with light, and there was the child, standing in a beautiful silver robe. He said, "I am the Christ child." Because little Fritz and Gretchen had befriended him, he pulled a branch from a fir tree outside the door and told them that it would always bear fruit for them at Christmas time. Then he left them. After he'd gone, the bough turned into a tree laden with silver nuts and golden apples and beautiful toys.
It's in memory of that first Christmas tree that children today decorate their little trees with coloured fruit and toys. But the origin of the Christmas tree goes back a long, long way to the time when the Anglo-Saxon missionaries were preaching in Germany. Here's one of the most popular German legends.
One December night, St. Boniface was walking in a wood when he came upon a group of pagans. They'd met beneath an oak tree, known as the Oak of Jupiter, to sacrifice a small boy. Boniface arrived just in time to save the child, and then he attempted to fell the tree. He'd barely cut the first notch when a mighty wind shook the oak, and it fell crashing to the ground. Behind it was left a little fir tree, which had been growing between the roots. Boniface turned to the speechless crowd. "From this night," he told them, "that little tree shall be your emblem. It is the wood of peace, for your houses are built of it. It is the sign of eternal life, for its leaves are evergreen. It points to heaven and shall henceforth be called the tree of the Christ child."
There's still another story about a tree, the green ash tree, and once again it's about a little shepherd who had no gift to offer baby Jesus. He was the only one to notice how cold Mary looked in her thin blue robe.
He took off his little sheepskin and wrapped it round her shoulders. But the baby was cold too in his manger of straw, and the shepherd boy said, "Why has no one lit a fire?" "We have no wood," said Joseph. So the little shepherd went out into the snow, this time without his coat, to look for wood. But no wood could he find. Then a few snowflakes fell gently onto his face, and he looked up to see the beautiful star which had guided them still shining over the stable. "Star," said the little boy, "show me where I may find some wood for a fire." The star shone over the fields and lit up the branches of an ash tree. Across the fields ran the little boy, and with his knife he cut off some of the lower twigs of the tree. They were so weighed down with snow that it was easy to reach them. Back he went to the stable, hugging his armful of twigs. When he went in, the other shepherds laughed at him. "Who ever heard of making a fire with wet green wood?" they said. The little boy threw down his heap of wood, and the tears started to his eyes. So then his gift was useless. But at that moment the baby woke, smiled, stretched out his hand to the bundle of twigs, and fell asleep again. There was a crackling sound, and suddenly the wood burst into flames, and soon there was a beautiful, warm, glowing fire in the stable to comfort the holy child.
Finally, a legend Russian children grow up with. It's about Babushka, or Little Grandmother.
Babushka was an old woman who lived long ago in a hut on the edge of a pine forest. One night, three wise men came to her door. They said they were following a star which was leading them to Bethlehem, where that night a great king had been born. And they were bearing beautiful gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And they asked Babushka to go with them and bring her gift with her. But she said no, the night was so cold and dark, and she had no gift to offer, so they went away. After they'd gone, Babushka wished she'd gone with them. She knew what gifts babies like. She got up from the fire and filled a big basket with toys that she kept to give to children. But when she tried to follow the wise men, no one could tell her which way they'd gone. So Babushka wandered and wandered, clutching her basket of toys, but she never did reach Bethlehem. So now, every Christmas Eve, she still wanders from place to place, and wherever she goes, she creeps into houses where children are sleeping and lays a toy on each pillow. Each child, she hopes, may really be the Christ child whom she is seeking.
Well, that was the first of my programmes to bring the Christmas spirit in. I'd like to thank Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett for the readings there. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.